Then I got to LA and I go to the improv and I'm doing a set and they give me a check for $8. And I'm like,
oh no, a check?
What the hell? A check, $8.75. And I was like, what the hell is this?
I could not imagine someone giving me a check as an adult for $8.75. But wait, Gina Yashere's story is so inspiring. So that little $8.75 check makes perfect sense. It was good for her. It motivated her. We got to pay some bills. You can fast forward if you like. But the next edition of Naked continues after the break.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women. And this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Greatest in sports and entertainment, connected with us. Every champion and carry champions to be a champion. A champion and carry champion, that girl, you did it. Got a champion and carry champion and carry champion.
Greatest in sports and entertainment, connected with us.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to another edition of Naked. I really like our next guest because I think she is the definition of hustle. Hustle personified. It's rare that I think I am out hustled, but she made me feel lazy. I need to do something with my life. Gina Yasharay was born in the UK. She's Nigerian. She's a comedian. She's also an actress. She's also a writer. She's also currently a showrunner on the hit show that she stars in or co-stars in. It's on CBS. It's called Bob Hart's Abby Shola. So go out and support your girl. And the reason why you would want to go support her is because she's really not an overnight success. Her story is one of, if you're not going to give it to me, I will go take it. This story should inspire you no matter what your discipline is, no matter what you do for a living. I appreciate Gina for telling her story. And of course, she's clearly hilarious. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. I just fresh from London yesterday, landed yesterday.
Oh,
from
wow.
The UK.
I got back 4 days ago.
Oh, really? Okay. So yeah. I want you to talk to me about growing up in London and living in London. What is that like for a Nigerian-born woman?
Well, I was born in London.
Born in London. Okay.
Yeah, my parents were born in Nigeria, but I was actually born and raised in London. My first few years were in an area of London called Bethnal Green, which is East London. I'm very much a Cockney by birth. But at the time of my birth in the 70s, England, especially East London, was going through a little bit of a change. There were a lot of immigrants from Africa, from the Caribbean, from India and Pakistan coming into East London because there was a lot of council, which is kind of the projects and kind of slum buildings. So that's where immigrants could get property. So the white working class Brits were not happy about all these immigrants coming into East London. So there was a lot of racist abuse on the streets, lots of skinheads, lots of graffiti. So that was kind of what I was brought up in the first for 10 years of my life. You know, I'd go out and my mum would be like, be careful of the bad boys. She used to call them the bad boys. And these were skinheads that would be waiting in the stairwell of the apartment building when you're going up the stairs and call your names and spit on you, that kind of thing. So that's what the first 8 to 10 years of living in London was like. Then we moved to North London, which was a little bit more affluent. And so racism wasn't quite as in your face there because it was kind of a more wealthier neighborhood. And then we, you know, my mum and my stepdad bought a house. So we left the projects and went into a house. And so it wasn't so bad. But I was a kid. I didn't know any different. I was like, this is just how it is. You just stay away from the bad white people.
And talk to the good white people.
Yeah, yeah.
Were the good white people easily identifiable as opposed to the bad white people?
Well, when I was at school, you know, I had a mixture of friends at school. You know, I was going to school at age 5, 6, 7. And, you know, I had black friends, white friends, Indian friends at school. We were just kids. We, at that age, we didn't really take on our parents' prejudices until sort of later. So age 4 or 5, we didn't know any different. We were just kids running around, just, hey. So I didn't recognize the racism per se. I just thought those are bad people who were spitting on me in the street. And these are my friends at school.
Okay. So then what I find interesting is that when I was reading your bio, it said that you did comedy for 20 years in the UK. Is that accurate?
I started comedy in 1995. So by the time I moved out to America in 2007, I'd been doing it about 12 years.
So tell me the start of comedic life for you in the UK. Because I could imagine your parents weren't necessarily excited about that career choice for you.
My mother was not happy at all. No.
She wanted you to be a doctor or an attorney, perhaps?
Yeah. Originally, she'd want me to be a doctor, but at 18... doing A-level biology, which is advanced level biology, we had to cut open a rat.
Mm.
And that's when I discovered that I could not stand the sight of the blood. It was disgusting to me. So I switched to engineering and I did my degree in electrical electronics engineering. And I actually worked as an engineer.
Mm.
My last job was working for Otis, the biggest elevator company in the world. I was building and repairing elevators for a living. So that was my last job. I was their first woman engineer in their 100-year history in the UK.
Wow.
Which sounds good, but it was a horrific experience because I was the first woman and a black woman at that. And I'm working on construction sites. So I'm walking into work and somebody's hung a banana skin above my overalls, or I put on my boiler suit and there are pictures of monkeys stuffed into the pockets, things like that. I put up with a lot of abuse at that job, but I stuck it out for 4 years because I refused to be driven out, and I wanted to stay there and prove that I can do the job as well as any of these men, which I did. But I ended up leaving, and that's how I ended up in comedy. I ended up leaving. The building industry went through a bit of a slump in the mid-90s, and they were making people redundant. They were laying people off. They were never going to lay me off because I was their token black girl that they put on all their posters and magazines and stuff. They were never going to lay me off, but I was like, I want to leave. So I marched into my manager's office. And I was like, you need to let me go. You need to pay me off and let me go because I don't want to be here anymore. And they were like, well, we have no intention of doing that. And I was like, well, unless you want me to go public with the racism and misogyny I've suffered on this job, you need to let me go. And they went, you know what? We're going to let you go.
Yeah.
So I left. And that was in the summertime. So I was like, I'm going to enjoy the summer off. So I was having a good time over the summer. And people had always told me I was funny. People always told me that I should be an actor. As a kid, you know, teachers were always saying to my mom, you know, your daughter Gina, she's very lively, she's fun. You know, maybe she should go in, you know, into acting or something. And my mom would always say, well, she can act like a doctor until she becomes a doctor. So they didn't know that she was not entertaining the prospect of me going into the arts. So after I left my job as an engineer, I thought, let me try this thing. You know, let me just do some fun things that I've always been kind of interested in, but never tried. And so, you know, I started going to workshops and I joined the Nation of Islam for about 12 minutes. And then I started getting into community work, doing stuff within my community. And they were doing a fundraiser one day and they were like, okay, singers and dancers. And so me and my two friends were always messing around doing our parents' accents, and I wrote what I thought was a play for us to perform.
What kind of play was it that you thought you guys were going to perform?
It was a play about the cultural differences between us, the first generation, you know, British born Nigerians, and our parents who come straight from Nigeria. And I wrote this play, but it turned out it wasn't a play. It was a comedy sketch. People laughed their asses off through the entire thing. And I was like,
and everyone was like, huh, I love it. I love it. Okay. I love it. Give me more.
And I was like, oh, this is comedy. So then we took that play / comedy sketch and we kept performing it at various talent competitions around London. And we kept winning these competitions with this one sketch. And then one day, two of my friends who were in this group with me didn't turn up for a competition we were in. And we were in the semifinals and they didn't turn up. And I was there on my own. And they were like, you got to go up on stage. You're due up on stage. And my two friends weren't there. So I kind of just went up on stage and talked for like 10 minutes and just told silly stories. And the audience loved it. And I got us through to the final with this monologue that I did. And then people were coming up to me afterwards going, you're a stand-up comic. That's what you are. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is this stand-up comedy? And then I started researching into that and started doing open mics. And I was like, I'm going to do this for a bit for fun because this is a good time. And people started going, oh, I'll give you 10 bucks. I'll give you 50 bucks if you come and do my show. And I'm like, 50 bucks for 5 minutes work? This is fantastic. This is more than I'm going to earn as an engineer. And I was like, I'm going to do this for 6 months. And then come winter, I'm going to go back and get a proper job and get another job as an engineer. And that just never happened. I ended up just continuing. And it's just never, I never ended up going back to work.
I was going to ask you too. I was like, if you went from being an engineer to stand-up comedian, how did you survive? But are you saying you were making more money initially starting out than you were as an engineer?
Not more money initially, but I was making money. So it was enough. You know, I had a very cheap apartment at the time, mm-hmm. so the rent was cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I owned my car outright. It was a paid-off car. I bought it cash. So I didn't need a lot of expenses. So I was like, well, as long as I'm making enough to pay this $200 a month rent
mm-hmm.
and enough to buy groceries,
mm-hmm.
that's all I need. Mm-hmm. And so from the beginning of my comedy career, I was making enough money to pay my $200 rent and to put food and put gas in the car. So I was like, well, I can survive off this small income. Let me see how much further this comedy will take me. And so I started driving all over the country, doing shows for nothing, just to build my experience and just to try and get. And that's what I did. And eventually, within 6 months, I landed on a talent show on television.
What was the name of the show?
It was called The Big, Big Talent Show. And it literally was comedians, ventriloquists, magicians, singers. It was everybody. And I was the only stand-up that got through to the final. And this is within 6 months of starting. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be a star. I've got on television within 6 months of starting this. I'm going to be huge. Forget engineering. I'm going to concentrate all my efforts on this comedy thing because I'm going to be a huge stand-up star. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, I think that it started off good for you, though, because this is a beautiful story. I hear stories. I interview a lot of comedians and it's never, I did it once and I was like, oh, I'm perfect. Very rarely, not perfect, but very rarely do I hear the story of I gave it a go and people were like, this is what you should be doing. Like you found where you belong. I look at how it's such a tough ask. What is the difference between being a stand-up comedian in the UK versus when you come to the States and you want to make it? Tell me the significant differences. Are the comedy clubs all the same? Do you have to grease the wheels and be friends with certain people to get time on stage? Like, tell me the rite of passage, if you will.
Well, in England, at the time that I was starting out, there were a lot of comedy clubs. And they all paid good money. So the difference is if you became good, and you got in at those comedy clubs, you'd get regular work. And it didn't matter whether you were famous or not, because the audiences went to the comedy clubs based on the comedy club's reputation. They didn't know who was going to be on. It's similar to how the comedy scene is in New York with the Comedy Cellars and the Gothams. For the most part, the Comedy Cellar people just go there because they know it's the Comedy Cellar and they know that they're going to get a great night of comedy. They don't necessarily know who's going to be on. And that's how the comedy scene was in England. You went, they booked you, everybody got the same money. Whether you were on the beginning of the show or the end of the show, everybody got whatever it was, $200 a set. And the MC got a little bit more because he or she had to be there all night. Whereas in London, I could do a set here, finish my set, and then jump in the car or jump on my motorbike, go to another comedy club, do another set. So I could make $400-$600 a night just running around. Doing shows. So that was the joy of doing comedy. And then when doing the comedy clubs, when you got to a stage in your career where people started to come to see you, if you were starting to get on television and starting to get known, then you transcended the comedy clubs into small theaters. So I did comedy clubs for about 7-8 years and I started to build a good audience and I started to get little bits of stuff on television. So people started to know me and go, oh, you're that girl off the TV. So then I transcended the comedy clubs and started booking my own theatres because I'd go to a comedy club and as soon as I walk on stage, they'd go, Jeannie Ashwin, and I'd hear the cheers. And I'd go, oh, those people are cheering really loudly, which means they know who I am. So if I was to go and book my own theatre, then rather than just being paid $200 for a set here, if I book a small theatre for 100 people and all those people are paying $10 each to come and see me, then I'm going to make a lot more money. So that's what I started doing. I started going into small theaters and building my own thing and doing my own shows. where it would just be me doing, rather than doing a 20-minute set at a comedy club, it'd be me on my own doing an hour, and then I'd get all the money. So that's what happens. That's the kind of rite of passage in England. You start off at the open mic, then you start getting paid at the comedy clubs. And a lot of comics, the majority of the comics stay at that comedy club level because not everybody gets on TV, not everybody gets famous. But if you stay at that comedy club level, you can still make 60 to 100,000 a year just doing comedy clubs.
Mm.
Even if nobody knows who you are,
mm.
you could run around the country because there were comedy clubs all over the country. You could run around all the country doing all the comedy clubs and making anywhere between 60 and 100 grand a year. And maybe more if you did corporate shows where a company will go, we need a comedian for our yearly Christmas party, and you'll get 5 or 10,000 or whatever. So as a no-name comedian in England, I was making a good living before I even got to the level where I was doing theatres.
Wow. Wow.
Whereas that is pretty much impossible in America.
Absolutely.
Because in America, when I came, and I didn't know that when I came here. So when I came to America, I was like, I'm a comedian. I'm a well-known comedian in England. I'm making a good living here. Once I get to America, I'll just go to the comedy clubs. They'll see how funny I am. I'll start getting booked, and I can at least make 60 grand a year doing comedy clubs in America until I get on TV and get a sitcom or get in a movie or something. That's what I thought. Then I got to LA and I go to the improv and I'm doing a set and they give me a check for $8. And I'm like,
oh no, a check?
What the hell? A check. $8. I remember my first check from the improv, $8.75. And I was like, what the hell is this? So basically, to headline a comedy club in America, it's a different beast. You have to be famous. So for a comedy club to book you as a headliner and pay you a decent fee, the onus is on you to bring the audience.
Mm.
So when an audience comes to a comedy club to see a headliner, they're coming because they've seen him on a sitcom or seen her on this show. And so you get paid according to that. But if you're not a big name comedian, they don't care how funny you are. You're not putting bums on seats. So when I got to America, I'm like, I'm really funny. I'm selling out theaters all over the country in the UK. And I'm a TV star in the UK. Can you pay me to do comedy? And they're like, we don't know who the hell you are. So nobody's paying to come and see you. You can open for this other comedian who's on a sitcom and they'll get whatever, $20,000 for the weekend. But you're going to get $8.75.
That's insane.
And that's what was happening in LA. It's very specific to LA because in LA, the comedy clubs, their attitude is very much, listen, you're in LA, you could be seen by Steven Spielberg. So we're doing you a favor by letting you perform at our comedy club.
For $8.75.
Yeah, the attitude. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense because the bar staff are being paid, the security are being paid, the people, you know, everybody else in the comedy club ecosystem is being paid except for the reason why the audience is there. That didn't make sense to me. And I couldn't understand why LA comedians were putting up with that. You know, I was like, why haven't you guys got a union? This doesn't even make sense to me.
Uh-huh.
But that's just how the system was set up in LA. Is everybody wants to be seen. Everybody wants to be seen, and they'll do these sets for peanuts and hoping to get an audition out of it, or hoping there's a casting director sitting in the crowd and it will lead to other things. But I'm like, when I came here, I was like, I'm a comedian. I don't care about being an actor. I'm a comedian. Like, there are in LA, there's a lot of actors pretending to be comedians, so they use stand up as a way to get as a calling card to get on TV. Then once they get on TV, they never do stand up again.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I am a comedian first and foremost. If I could make $500,000 or $1 million a year just doing stand up, I would never step foot in an audition room. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that was me. So when I came here, I was like, I want to do stand-up. I don't care about whether there's a casting agent sitting in the crowd. I want to make a living doing what I do, which is stand-up. And I struggled for 7 years in LA earning peanuts. And I'd have to keep going. So every month I'd have to go back to England I'd call my agent in England and I'd go, time for a bank raid. And I'd fly back to England, do a bunch of shows, make my money, and then bring that money back to LA and live off that money because I was making no money in LA.
Hey, everybody, we got to pay some bills and we will be right back with Gina Yashere. Every champion and carry champions to be a champion, a champion and carry champion and carry champion, a champion and carry champion and carry champion. Greatest, greatest in sports and entertainment, connected with.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Champion and carry champions to be a champion, a champion and carry champion, and girl, you did it. Got a champion and carry champion and carry champion. Greatest, greatest in sports and entertainment, get naked with. Welcome back to this edition of Naked. Actress, comedian, all around badass, Gina Yashere is still here with us.
You said it's time for a bank raid. You needed to go and get your cash, come back here. Yeah. And stuff. Well, why did you want to just stay there in the UK? Why did you want to, quote unquote, do it here in the States?
Because I'd hit a glass ceiling. As a black comedian in England, I'd hit a glass ceiling. I'd got to a certain level of fame and fortune. And I was coming out with white comedians who were very similar to me in talent. And they were... where I was selling theatres based on my own hard work. You know, I could sell out a 2,000-seater theatre, perhaps. My white peers were able to do 17,000-seater stadiums because they were given a lot more opportunities to be on TV. So I'd always be the guest on someone else's TV, but I could never get on someone else's TV show, but I could never get my own TV show as a black woman. Whereas my white peers who I came up with were all getting their own TV shows, which then led to them being exposed to a much larger audience, which meant they can go and do these massive tours. And I was never going to get to that because the TV industry in England is run by old white men who only give TV shows to other white men. So I'd hit a glass ceiling. And for me, as a child living in England, I'd always known from the age of 4, I knew that England was not where I was supposed to be. I was supposed to be in America. From childhood, I thought American kids had a better life. You know, every TV show I saw was American kids running to the beach to hang out with their friends on the beach and riding bikes around town, solving crimes. So I always thought that the kids in America had a much better life. So from childhood, I wanted to be in America. Even when I worked as an engineer, I worked for Otis, which was an American company, because my plan was to transfer and become an engineer in America. Always, my plan had always been to come to America from the age of 4. So then when I started doing comedy, I was like, well, America's the home of comedy. So one day I'm going to go to America and do comedy. So even when I started out, even when I was doing really well in England, I'd fly out to America every year and just go to comedy clubs and just go up and do my stuff just to see if my stuff traveled. So I knew I could perform in America long before I moved here because I was out here coming out on vacations, getting to New York, going to Miami, just going up at comedy clubs and going, I'm a comedian from England. Let me go up and do 5 minutes. You don't even have to pay me. And I just go up and do 5 minutes. So I always knew. And I knew that and when I hit that glass ceiling in England, that was even more, of an incentive for me to get the hell out.
Yeah, to do what you... So you... It's interesting, I feel like Hollywood is run by white men, but there is more of an opportunity for you to thrive than there is one in the UK.
Yeah, I always say that I hit the glass ceiling in the UK and I was probably making at that point 150 grand a year.
Uh-huh.
But when you hit the glass ceiling for black performers in America is much higher than the one in the UK.
Yeah.
Even if I hit the glass ceiling in America, I can hit the glass ceiling as a millionaire.
Uh-huh.
You know what
you're right.
Saying?
You're right.
I was like, I'd rather go to America and hit that glass ceiling because at you're least right. I'll be a millionaire when I hit it and I can cry in my money.
Yeah. It's so awful here, but I've got my money. So then you come here, you get on the circuit, $875, something I'll never, ever forget. That's robbery. But it is, I know the scene. I'm very familiar with how people are like, this is how you're going to make it. You start working. How long does it take you in terms of years? 5 years, 6 years, when you finally get to a point where you are moving comfortably and not making $875 a show?
After I moved to New York. So I was in LA for 7 years. And then in those 7 years, every year, I'd fly to New York and just ingratiate myself with all the comedy clubs in New York. So I got into The Cellar. I got into the Gotham Comedy Club and I just started I'd do like 2 or 3 weeks in New York. And the comedy clubs in New York paid decently.
Mm.
Not as much as they paid in England, but you could do a bunch of sets around New York, get $120 here, $100 here, $80 here. So over a weekend, you could make 1,000 to $1,200 to $1,500 over a weekend, just doing sets all over New York, just running around New York, doing different comedy clubs, because they paid anywhere between $50 and $130 for a set. Some clubs even pay $200 a set. So I was like, oh, the comedy clubs in New York, it's merit-based. It's not based on who your agent knows. Because in LA, I couldn't get on at a lot of the comedy clubs in LA because I didn't have a big-name agent who could make a call and get me on stage there. Whereas in comedy in New York, the comedy clubs, it was more merit-based. If you're good, you got booked. So I'd go, when I was living in LA, I fly to New York every year, and I'd come back to LA with my pockets full of cash. And I was like, oh, if I go to New York, I can actually make somewhat of a living in New York while I'm waiting for the big break. So I left LA after 7 years. I'm like, I'm going to New York because I want to do comedy. I don't want to go for auditions. I can't do an American accent. I don't want to play the security guard on Young Sheldon. I want to be... I didn't want that. So I was like, I saw a lot of my agents kept sending me auditions, and I was like, I don't want that. I'm not going to turn up for this audition. You know, I'm not going to learn an American accent so I can be the fucking, the sassy security. or, you know,
yeah, exactly. I know. We just need some diversity in this episode. Yeah. So put in the black security guard. Yeah. I got it.
So I refused to go for those auditions. So I was like, I'm going to go to New York and do comedy there. And I'm just going to do comedy. And then from there, I'll try and get booked to comedy clubs around the country and just try to make a living. So I moved to New York. And in between my on-the-road gigs where I'd go to a comedy club in wherever, Philadelphia, and do a weekend at a comedy club, I'd be able to work in the city. So I didn't have to go to London so often to do the bank raid, because I could work and earn my rent money doing comedy clubs in New York. And then from then I started to get booked for, you know, I started making my own specials. So I was trying to get stand-up specials on Showtime and Netflix, and nobody would give me a special. So I was like, well then, fuck you guys, I'm going to make my own special. So my first special I made in London in 2008, went to London, sold out a 2,000-seater theater, booked my own camera crew, my own director, and shot my own special.
Good for you.
And then I got that special, and I sent it to Showtime. And I was like, what do you think of this? And they were like, this is nice. We'll buy it off you. We'll option it for a year. So that's what they did. I sold my first special called Skinny Bitch to Showtime. And they paid me a lump sum. It wasn't a lot of money. It was like maybe 50, 60 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a nice chunk of money that I could go, oh, I can live on this. I can live on this for a good year while I'm still hustling to make it.
Yes.
So I did that. I sold that first special to Showtime. Then I made my second special I made in San Francisco. Nobody knew who I was. I was still living in LA. It was in the interim between the time I was moving from, because I spent a year closing down my life in LA. To New York. I spent a year just slowly winding everything down. And it was in that year I shot my second special, Laughing to America. I shot it in San Francisco. Didn't want to shoot it in LA because LA audiences are full of actors who are not looking at the cameras for this.
And they're not and they're not generous with their laughter either. They're stingy. Yeah.
So yeah. I was like, let me shoot it in San Francisco where there's real people. So I rented a theater 9 months in advance in San Francisco, just rented this theater. Nobody knew who I was. So what I would do for the next 9-10 months, every weekend, I would fly or drive to Los Angeles, from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and I'd go around every comedy club, every venue in San Francisco, and do shows for free. Go up and go, can you just let me do 5 minutes? You don't have to pay me. And I'd go up and do a set. I'd kill, and then after those sets, I'd stand outside handing out flyers for my special that I was shooting 9 months later. And I'd do that every weekend for nearly a year. I did that. And by doing that, I managed to sell out this little 350-seater theater.
Good for you.
In San Francisco. And then I flew my director over from London, from England. So I got an Airbnb. I've got a house in San Francisco, an Airbnb. And I flew everybody from England because it was cheaper to fly my guy from America to direct the special than to book an American director. Couldn't afford an American one. So I flew him over and then he sourced the camera crew in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
So he did all the technical stuff. I concentrated on getting the theater, selling tickets, sold this place out. And then I shot my own special in San Francisco. Shot this special in San Francisco, got the DVD, and then was like, who wants it?
So you were like a legit how rappers back in the day did their mixtapes. You gave out your comedic mixtapes. Like, so let me just tell you, this is the hottest shit on the block. Go ahead and get it. Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
So I made my special. I was selling it at shows. And then I ended up optioning that one to NBC CISO. Do you remember when NBC tried to do their own version of Netflix? It was called CISO.
No, I don't.
It lasted about 30
But you sold it.
But I sold them the special and they paid me a nice chunk for that. And then when CISO died a death, the ownership of the special reverted back to me.
Good for you.
I sold it to them. Yeah, I sold it to them because what I used to do, I didn't sell it to them outright. I'd go, you can have it for 12 months.
Yeah.
So it was like a lease almost.
Uh-huh.
So when CISO went defunct, the special converted back to me as owner and I resold it to Sirius. So now I made it into a sound file and now it plays on Sirius and I get checks every month for my specials playing on Sirius.
So long story short, you're rich is what you're trying to tell us.
I'm not rich. I'm definitely not. I didn't get rich from that, but I earned a good living from it. That was able to sustain me while I was hustling. And then I started, then I got booked on The Daily Show as a British correspondent. So that didn't pay much money, but it got me a little bit of
notoriety,
which helped get other things. The moment I started, and so I was earning good living. You know, at that point, I was comfortable. You know, I wasn't earning buy a house money in America, but I was earning rent a nice place money. You know what I mean? I've never had a roommate. I've never done any of that. Even when I came to LA, I had my own apartment. I was like, I'm a grown ass woman. I'm not doing roommates. I have to, because I owned property before I came here. I owned two houses.
You lived a whole nother life that you just couldn't.
I had a house.
I
had a house. I had a car. I had properties. So I was like, I'm going to come here and start again for less money and make no money. But I will not compromise on my living situation. I have to have my own.
Yeah. And no one wants to be bothered. Who wants to be bothered? Yeah. So I will ask this then. CBS show, Bob Hart's Abishola. Am I saying it right?
Yeah. Yes.
Abishola.
That's when everything changed.
So tell me, now I was thinking as you're telling this story, you're a very specific type of actor. Like that's what the role you would get would be who you are. Not who you are, but you didn't have to change too much of yourself. Tell me about the role you play on this show and how that impacted your life.
Well, originally, I didn't start as an actor on the show. I wasn't meant to be an actor on the show. Uh-huh. When I was living in New York, I got a call from Chuck Lorre's production company that Chuck had an idea for this TV show, but he wanted a Nigerian comedian to help him create it. Uh-huh. So he just finished Mike and Molly. He wanted to make another show about another couple, but he didn't want to make another Mike and Molly. He wanted the female protagonist to be an African woman. Mm-hmm. And so they called me over ostensibly to help them create the show, help them write it. Because they're like, we're three white guys. We don't know how to write about Africans. It's going to be an immigrant. You know, the half cast is going to be immigrants. We need someone who can help us write. So I came on originally as a consultant. Then I went from consultant to co-creator and producer. And then, so I was helping them write the pilot. And obviously, I'm a comedian, and my dream has always been to be the funny best friend in a sitcom. So I wrote myself in as her best friend. I didn't want the lead role, because I was like, I don't want the lead role, because I'm going to be writing this show. But the funny best friend is always the fun, gets the best lines, and I don't have to carry the show. It's not based on me. You know, so let's get some beautiful woman to be the lead actress, and let me be the funny friend. So I wrote myself in as the best friend. The character is kind of based on my mother and how my mother is around her friends. Abishola is based on my mum, the harsh side of my mum, the serious mother, you know, matriarch side of my mum. And then Takemi is based on my mum when she's around her friends. Every champion and carry champions to be a champion, a champion and carry champion and carry champion, a champion and carry champion and carry champion. Greatest in sports and entertainment, connected with.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Champion and carry
champions to be a champion. Got a champion and carry champion. Hey girl, you did it. Got a champion and carry champion and carry champion.
Greatest in sports and entertainment. Connected with.
All right, so you're the best friend is Kimmy, who's based off how your mom behaves around her friends. Abby Shola is based off of your mother. So you have the best lines. And you wrote yourself in. Now, did you write yourself in as a series regular, or you just wrote yourself in for just the pilot?
Originally, I was just, Kimmy didn't even have a name. She was Woman on the Bus. And we wrote the pilot, and Chuck comes in one day because they didn't know. I didn't tell them I wanted that part. I was subliminally feeding them information, going, you know what? You know, Abishola needs a best friend. Don't you think she needs a best friend? But I didn't tell them that I wanted that role. So then one day, Chuck comes in and goes, okay, this pilot is almost finished. I think it's going to be a goer. I think CBS is going to like it. If you want the role of Abishola, you're going to have to audition. And I went, I don't want the role of Abishola. And they were like, what? I was like, I want, and I pointed to the whiteboard and I was like, Woman on the Bus. I want Woman on the Bus. And he looked at me and he was like, you're very fucking smart. So originally she was just a guest star. But that was only because they didn't know what I was bringing to this role, because Chuck and them lot had just found me. If I tell you the story, when I asked them how they found me, when they brought me over to LA for our first meeting, I was like, how did you find me? And I'm assuming they were going to go, oh, we've seen you on Netflix specials. We saw you on The Daily Show. We've seen you on The Tonight Show. We've been following your work. What they said was, oh, no, we Googled Nigerian female comedian.
Yo, are you serious?
100%. That is how they found me. So they didn't know anything about me. They just went, they Googled Nigerian comedian, a set that I'd done on TV in England came up and they were like, oh, she's funny. Get her over here for this meeting.
Wow.
So they'd done no research on me.
No, I want to say, I was like, that was it. They just Googled one person and that was it?
Yep. They Googled and I was the best one that came up because obviously I am the best. And Clearly. They were like, where is she? And they were like, oh, she's in New York. Fantastic. Get her over for a meeting. So they flew me from New York to LA for this meeting. So they'd done no research. So when I created this best friend character, they just assumed it was just going to be a guest starring character that might pop in once every 10 episodes. But what they didn't know is that I had a long career of creating characters in England for television. And this was a character that I'd been waiting to play on a sitcom for years.
Mm.
So I knew that once they saw this character, they were going to fall in love with this character. So we shot the pilot. Now, in the pilot, my character had literally three lines in the whole pilot. But when they put the trailer of the show out, every one of those three lines was on the trailer.
Mm.
So they obviously saw the character and they were like, oh, we love this character. And then obviously I'm in the writer's room. So I'm writing. So for the first few episodes of season one, I was just guest star, getting guest star rates, which was a fraction of what the other actors were getting. But I'm in the writer's room, so I'm seeing that I'm in every episode, because every time we wrote an episode, Chuck will come into the room and go, wait, I don't see Kimmy. Put Kimmy in. So I called my agent and I was like, listen, we're at episode 8 we've got to so far of the story setups, the outlines of these stories. We've outlined 8 episodes so far and Kimmy's in every single one of them. So you need to go back and get me bumped up from guest star, because this is obviously, I'm a series regular now, but I'm not getting series regular money. So my agent went back and renegotiated and I became a series regular.
I love it. You're so, you don't understand how this is really so right on time for me. I love it. I love your hustle. I love it, whatever it takes. I love how smart you are. I love how you were fighting for yourself always. I love how you didn't want the main role because everyone was all about, I want to be on TV. You're like, I want to do the real shit y'all remember. I love it. I love it. I love it. Congratulations to you. Just amazing. Do you ever just sit and marvel at what you've been able to accomplish?
No, because I'm so competitive. I'm like, all right. And you know, sometimes I, you know, And sometimes I've had to force myself to sit down and just enjoy the moment. Because obviously, I'm like, I've got a sitcom on TV. I'm making amazing money now. And I've managed to buy two houses in Los Angeles off of it. I'm like, okay, I'm doing well.
The first check was $8.75.
Yeah.
And I got two houses. Yeah. Talk your shit, Gina.
Yeah.
I am so happy for you. My producer's going to have to bleep out all my curse words.
Sorry.
No, it doesn't matter. I'm kidding. I'm joking. She's probably like, y'all silly. I will say this. What is it about ambitious people that can't appreciate what you have? Because I see the distance. And when you tell this story, I'm marveling. All I imagine is seeing you out there. Let me just have 5 minutes driving back and forth, a ride to LA to San Francisco is not a small one. It's a 8 hour drive. You're going back and forth for a year. You're flying, maybe you're driving, you're selling yourself so that you can sell yourself. And you like, I'm gonna fly on my own. You're doing everything it takes because they wouldn't do it for you. So I'm gonna do it myself. Do you see the distance between then and now?
Yes, I definitely do. And I have to sit down, you know, because, and I tell you what, you know, as I've got a very competitive spirit. So I often, you know, Instagram and these social medias is a good thing, is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because you're watching other people and going, how have they got that? I'm better than they are. You know, I was doing a lot of that.
Same.
And I had to, you know, and I tell you when everything changed for me before I got this show, one day I sat myself down and I was getting very angry and very bitter when things weren't going my way. And I was like, why am I struggling so much when I'm this good? And you got these mediocre people just sailing through and just getting opportunities after opportunity. And then I had to sit myself down and go, listen, you're doing comedy for a living. You're making a very good living doing something you love. 99% of people on the planet are not doing things that they love for a living. You're doing something you love. You're traveling the world and telling jokes, and that is paying your bills. Stop complaining. Stop looking sideways at other people and just concentrate on enjoying this journey. And that slight change in mindset opened the world up for me. The moment I started doing that, it's like the universe was like, oh, okay, you're ready now. And that's when everything started to click into place. Then the special started coming. I started getting more TV work. And then this show landed. And that was after I went, I'm just going to enjoy the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm doing really well. Mm-hmm. I'm making good money. I have to try and sit myself down again. Because now I'm like,
now,
why aren't we getting Emmy nominations? Why is this show getting Emmy nominations and we ain't? I'm getting into that mindset again. So I have to sit down and go, Gina, 7 years ago, you would have killed to be in the position you're in now where you're a showrunner. You wouldn't even have known you. And I had no intention of writing on TV shows. People were offering me writing gigs for years and I refused because I was like, I don't want to work in no office. I don't want no one telling me what to do. And I've heard horror stories about how writers' rooms are for Black writers. So I never took writing gigs. Now I'm showrunning a show. I'm the showrunner.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, I'm hiring Black writers and I'm making sure that they will get opportunities going forward from this. I provided work for Black actors that wouldn't have got anything in this industry. So I have to sit myself down and go, 5 years ago, you would never have known that you'd be in the position you're in now.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. It's an adventure.
Hey.
Don't be looking at other people's TV shows and comparing yourself. So I've got to do that mindset change again.
You got to. And if you need me to hype you up, but you did get a good Black woman to hype up another one. I hype you up. That's my job. I'm so impressed. Gina, you have motivated me. Like in my world and what I do, I love this because I'm going to go get it. You're not going to give it to me. I'm going to take it. You're not going to give me a special. I'll make my own.
Do not wait for the gatekeepers to validate you.
You got to go take the power you want because they're not giving it away. Yeah. Amen. Amen. Okay. So in that same vein, but still keeping focus, what's next? What can I tell? Obviously, we need to watch Bob Hart's Abishola. And then we also
Bob, as in Bob, Hearts, as in Loves, Abishola. And that's on CBS. And then...
And it's on Max. I think it's on Max. And I think it's on Amazon. Yeah, it was on the first three seasons were on HBO Max. But I know that's now changed to Max. So I think it might have migrated over to Max. And I've seen it on Amazon Prime. So it's out there to watch.
It is easy to find. And I'll be the biggest advocate. Can I... And then what else do you have? Are you in... Are you doing any stand-up in... coming up soon in LA? Or
yes, I'm doing a tour right now called The Woman King of Comedy.
Hey!
Yeah.
And where can we find out more? What website?
My website, GinaYashere.com. Just go to the website. I've got all the links for all the shows. I'm doing New York next month. I'm doing San Francisco. I'm doing Chicago. I'm doing Portland, Detroit, Los Angeles, and I'm sure I'm missing one, but they're all listed on my website, GinaYashere.com. The Woman King of Comedy. It's going to be a really fun show. Me, a couple of comedians, probably going to get a DJ on stage so we can have fun. It's going to be a good night. So I'm doing that. I've got a book, a memoir out called Cat Candid, which means left-handed and awkward.
Yeah. When did you write that? I was going to ask you about. When did you write it?
I wrote that during the first few months of the pandemic, the shutdown.
Okay.
I got the deal a year before I got the TV show, but I'm a terrible procrastinator and hadn't written a word. And then I got the TV show and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how I'm going to have time to write this book because I'm now writing this TV show. And then the pandemic happened and I was like, okay, that's giving me, you know.
You have nothing but time. Yeah.
And I wrote that book during the first 4 months of the pandemic.
Good for you. So
that came out last year in the States, and it came out in paperback recently in England. And after Bob Hart's Abishola, that's the next show I'm working on. I'm going to be turning that memoir into a scripted series, like a grittier version of Everybody Hates Chris. So it's going to be the book covers my life from birth to the day I step on a plane to move to America. So it's going to be covering different aspects of my life, and it's going to be me narrating it, hopefully, with a younger actor playing me. And it's been gritty. He's going to be like, and this is the moment I decided to punch the bitch in the face. You know, says grittier. So that will be the next project. But the next immediate stuff is, I'm on tour. The Woman King of Comedy, coming to your city.
We're putting this all in the note. They will find it. I will also post it on Instagram and every other social media outlet that I have. Wow. Gina, thank you for inspiring us today. And I am truly, I'm truly moved by your hustle, because I thought I had hustle. You're like, no, let me just move over. Let me share. Good for you. Let me share what this hustle looks like now. You deserve it all. You deserve it all. You deserve it all and more. And I hope you can really appreciate the distance. That's what I try to, for myself, see where it used to be and where I am. Thank you for coming on, Nathan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And again, don't forget, you need to go get her memoirs called Cat Handled. It's basically about her life story. Everything she shared with us, but more detail, more gritty, and obviously more entertaining. I appreciate her coming on the show. I feel motivated. I feel also the need to say I should appreciate the distance. I am giving you all that message today. You may not be exactly where you want to be in your personal life or in your professional life, but you can always see the distance. I say that a lot, but it's so true. I'm in this phase of my life where I'm just trying to appreciate what I've accomplished, although I still have so much more to do. And we're always on our own timeline, but when it's supposed to be, it is supposed to be. Gina Yashere, thank you for that message. And thank you all for listening. Naked back next week. Have a good one, y'all.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.